Calls with Whitley Strieber, a little discussion about hybrids when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Whitley Strieber with us. We'll get to your calls in just a second. Whitley, we've had stories, of course, about hybrids, people who claim they've been abducted by ETs, that women claim that the fetus has been taken or something has been going on. What's your take on the alien-human hybrid story, real or not? Well, is there any Whitley there? All right, we'll check and see where Whitley is, and maybe he disappeared. Maybe he was abducted himself. So we'll try to get Whitley back on as quickly as we can. If not, we're going to go to your calls, too, and keep checking in for it. Let's go back to Whitley.
Hey, are we there?
Yeah, there you are, Whitley. You were gone before.
Okay, I got lost in the ether there for a while.
Really? Did you hear my question
at
all?
I did, and I answered it, and you clearly did not hear me.
We did not hear you at all.
Okay, so what I was going to say is that something is going on, and we always assume that, well, if there are alien-human hybrids, they must have made them. But is that really an assumption we should stick to? Because there's two sides to this coin. I think it's an open question as to what they are and who brought them about and how. We don't know. I mean, we just do not know. I have, back years ago, and I've talked about this on Coast before, I won't belabor it. I had, Ann and I had this fellow show up at our cabin behind the, he seemed to be living in the woods behind the cabin, who was really strange. He was short and looked like a child at first, but he was sort of weathered and clearly not playing with any kind of deck of cards that I ever played with in my life. And he was watching us and watching over us. He was extremely edgy and nervous and wouldn't let you get near him. He was almost like an animal in a way. And yet we went hiking once. And he would smoke a lot. And one of the first things we noticed, reasons we noticed him, was we would smell cigarette smoke in the house in the early mornings, and the air was still. And that was odd because the house was way out in the middle of nowhere, and there was supposedly nobody around there smoking, so, you know, or around there at all. So, you know, we became noticed that. And we found a place about a mile back in the woods where somebody had been standing there and smoking a wad and dropping cigarette butts. And, you know, I said to Annie, there's somebody out after. Mm-hmm. And I had seen him. I saw him. I walked up to him one time. I thought he was a child smoking under a tree. And he clearly was not a child. And he really scared me. And I went back to the house. And then we used to skinny dip because our swimming pool, in the dear days when I had a swimming pool, one long gone from my life, was very private, and we would skinny dip normally. We wouldn't swim in suits. Why bother? And we went out to swim as usual after he had showed up. And the woods were very full behind our deck. In other words, you could see a wall of green, but you couldn't see under the trees. And there was a area under those trees where there were a lot of leaves and sticks and stuff. And we hear him running up and down in that area, gasping and making a lot of noise with the leaves and cracking sticks and stuff. And, you know, he was obviously worried about our being out there naked. And so we went inside and I said, Annie, I think he's guarding us. I think he's guarding us. And, you know, we tried to be forthcoming, but he was like a brilliant animal. You couldn't get near him. He's too scared of us. Then we lost the cabin, went down to Texas to live in a little condo. Darn if he didn't show up there.
Same guy. Weird.
Yeah, and he was there for a while and finally moved on. I mean, he was there hanging out near the our condo, and these two weird men showed up, and they squatted in a condo across a little alley from us. It turned
out. Were you being followed?
Followed, of course.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I don't know. I got the distinct impression he could read your mind. In fact, I'm sure he could. And I think he couldn't stop doing it, and I think it made him very nervous. I think it was one of the things about him that made it so hard for him, because, you know, when you try to approach him, you'd feel uneasy and fear, and he'd pick up on that immediately. And it was like he was being hit by a wall of fear, and, you know, he was really having a hard time.
Are these apparent hybrids, are they, would you call them menacing?
Call them what?
Menacing? Troublemakers?
He wasn't menacing to me. He was very troubled. Obviously very troubled.
Within himself.
The men that were with him were pretty creepy. I would say they were menacing. Yeah, they're definitely not people I would have enjoyed having dinner with, let me tell you that.
Why would there even be an alien-human hybrid program? What's the purpose?
If there is. I mean,
if there is, yeah.
Was he? I don't know. Maybe it's something that shouldn't have been done.
When I was younger, I thought maybe what they were trying to do was to create an army of people to inherit this planet if something were to go wrong and we couldn't survive.
Well, if we can't survive here, why would hybrids be able to?
Well, maybe they were genetically altered to breathe better or something, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it maybe, I don't know, but he didn't seem too happy here. He really did not. I think he was miserable.
Did he seem out of place?
Yeah, he was so out of place in the condo complex that people called social services because they thought he was a feral child.
That's strange. Let's take a few calls, and I want to get into your book, Supernatural, too. Great. Let's go to first-time caller Joe in Port Richey, Florida. Joe, you're on with Whitley Strieber. Go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, Joe.
I just wanted to relay an event that happened to my ex-wife and I.
Okay.
We were on vacation coming down from Reno, Nevada, and we stopped in Alamo, Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
And we went out about 3 o'clock in the morning back to the Alien Research Center across from Area 51 on the ET Highway. And we went back there because it was on a plateau. We turned the car around. He turned off the headlights and immediately take it up to half the windshield in front of the car with a triangular-shaped craft just hovering there.
Just there. Bang.
Just, yeah. I couldn't believe it. First, you know, as soon as we got there, I got out of the car to see if it was making any noise. I couldn't hear anything at all. It was completely silent. And it was so dark, I couldn't even see the car right next to me. I did hear cows mooing at the object across the street. It was a cattle ranch. They were moving at that object up there.
These cows tend to react to these sightings. I have a friend of mine who's a reporter in St. Louis, Whitley. Years ago, he was assigned to go out to Elgin, Missouri, where there were reports of UFO sightings. And he saw a dead cow and 15 other cows walking in a circle around it. They would not go in beyond this imaginary circle, but they would just walk around this dead cow. It was weird.
Well, you know, some years ago, I was contacted by a man when I was living in South Texas, who said he had some kind of a strange formation in one of his pastures. He was a cattle rancher, and he had called the local MUFON people, and they wouldn't do anything about it. So I got a group of people from Southwest Research, and we got a bunch of equipment, and we went down there to look at it. And his cows, it was a circle about 10 or 12 feet in diameter in the grass. It was nothing, it was not like a elaborate crop circle. It was nothing really spectacular. But all of his cows were facing directly into it in a circle around it, and you couldn't get them. You had to work to drive them off. And he said every time I get them out of there, if I let them back in this pasture, they go right back to it.
It is strange, yeah. He also saw a tree with what he said were thousands of dead flies scorched onto the side of the tree trunk.
Oh, my God.
Now, how do you explain that?
That I would not like to have seen. No idea. There's so much stuff in this experience that is completely beyond explanation.
Really is. Thomas in La Jolla, California. Welcome to the show, Thomas.
Hi, George. Thank you for taking my call.
Got
and
it.
Whitley Strieber, it's an honor and a pleasure. Whitley, at the same time that you wrote and published Communion, you wrote another book, which was called War Day. And War Day, for the Coast audience, is about a limited, very limited nuclear exchange between Russia and the United States. And it's the best, in my opinion, the best fictional creation, recreation of what a nuclear war might look like, you know, while it's happening and mm-hmm. then afterwards. And I've wondered, have you ever thought of, 30 years ago we were in danger of nuclear war, but perhaps we're in danger now more than ever, and not because of leaders, but because, as your book pointed out, perhaps a trigger event, you know, something that cascades out of control. I'm wondering if you've ever planned to update, reissue War Day, or perhaps turn it into a documentary?
No, or maybe you've given him a new idea. Go ahead.
Well, I do think about that. You can go to unknowncountry.com and get a copy of the original War Day for $3.99 for your Kindle if you want to. It's there. I do think about that, and I think that, you know, War Day was about how there can be an imbalance that can occur in between countries that have nuclear weapons, where nobody is sure whether or not the other person is going to fire first, and the one who fires first wins. This is the fear, and it's certainly not true between us and North Korea, because they don't have, if they have even got nuclear weapons, that can reach any significant country.
And I want to ask you about that, Whitley, because of your book, War Games.
Well, I don't think that they really matter that much yet. I do think that...
But do we wait out until you don't say yet anymore?
Well, I think that the president has got a point about facing up to them, because all the other presidents from Bush Sr. on...
They all let him get to where they are today.
...have tried to negotiate with him, obviously, with them, and not just with this one, but the previous ones. Doesn't work. And he seems to have quieted down a good bit since...
Yeah, before the storm.
Trump appeared to be completely crazy, and I think that sort of scared him off.
He said, this guy's crazier than me. Oh, boy.
Yeah, well, I think that's exactly what the intent was, to make him think, well, wait a minute, this guy could, maybe he could, he'll do it. I better be careful. But that's not the solution either. That's a temporary solution. The long-term solution is we got to be sure that they can't do it.
That's right.
And we have to figure out how to do that. And we can't get that done unless the Chinese...
They have to help.
They have to realize that they can't. This instability is not going to stand, and the only way you can get them to realize that is if they end up afraid that they will be pulled in to any nuclear exchange with North Korea, that it won't be isolated to Korea, that it will also involve the Chinese mainland. And once they are convinced of that, then they will take steps to do something about what's happening in North Korea.
That's right. Would you trust the leader of North Korea with nuke-tipped missiles that could reach the United States?
I wouldn't trust the leader of North Korea with a dead rat.
Exactly.
I mean, let's face it, he's a creepy little...
Well, he killed his uncle. He killed his half brother. You know, he killed his uncle because the uncle wanted the half brother to run North Korea.
Yeah,
he heard about it from somebody in China.
He killed off everybody in his family.
Yeah, wiped them all out. Yeah,
he stripped every family member who was friendly with the Chinese out of his government and killed them all and
brutally too.
Yeah, and this is a pretty clear sign of where he stands and where China stands with him, because, you know, China is the answer, but he is forging his own path, this man. It's a dangerous situation, too, because the problem is that if we end up in a situation where there is a nuclear exchange between us and North Korea, we might take something terrible might happen here, but North Korea is going to disappear from the face of the earth. And then what do the Russians do while these missiles are flying? Do they open their silos and do they begin to move their portable missiles? In other words, do they go on a war footing?
Mm-hmm.
And if they do go on a war footing, then we're in the same situation we were in World War I.
That's right, exactly.
Which is that...
And then we notify our subs that have nukes.
Right. And it turns out that whoever fires first is going to win, and or has the best chance of winning. I should say nobody wins a nuclear.
Nobody wins. Nobody wins.
But that's the danger. That's what War Day is about. It's about a situation that developed like that, and all of a sudden there was a nuclear exchange.
Well, and if they launch, I'm talking about Russia. It's not going to be one. It's going to be many. And our retaliation at the same time.
It would be the end of the world.
Yeah, it's over. It's over.
Because some of the residue radioactive waste from a nuclear bomb lasts for thousands of years, and this would be really over. The human race will have failed if that happens.
How sad. Jason in Syracuse, New York. Welcome to the program, Jason. You are on the air. Go ahead, Jason.
Thanks, George. It's a pleasure to talk with you and Whitley.
Thank you.
I actually want to let you guys know, Whitley, what a great body of work you have. The reason I'm calling is I'm 46, and throughout my life I've had a bunch of really weird things happen to me. And throughout trying to figure out, you know, get answers to these issues that I've had, I came across your book. So I have several of your books. But the reason I called, I wanted to ask you regarding if you've ever experienced any phenomenon after your experiences that have any regard to eye phenomenon. It seems like every time I'm contacted, the following day I experience these eye phenomenon where I have these visual images that are burned into my retina.
That's an interesting take. Hold on, Whitley. We'll have you answer that when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, Ghosts of the Civil War, and we're going to come back in a moment with Whitley Strieber and take final phone calls as well. We'll get into that question of the individual, of course, Jason in Syracuse, New York, who is seeing paranormal things almost like etched into his eyeball. Strange, strange stuff. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We are back with Whitley Strieber. Whitley's website linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Let's go back to East, Jason at Syracuse, New York. So, Jason, you kind of see visually in your head or etched to your eye these visions, and what are the visions of?
Well, actually, Whitley, on a couple of occasions, what I've done is I keep a good log, and I keep a journal of all this. One of the first occasions I had this visual phenomenon I have, they almost appear like hieroglyphics, but they're not quite hieroglyphics. And what happens is upon waking, it's almost like looking into a flashlight for too long. And this visual phenomenon almost seems like it's burned into the back of my retina, and it continues and persists for probably a good hour after I wake up.
And then it fades away?
And then it slowly fades away. And not only did I have these hieroglyphics, but I also have other geometric-style, like, type designs. And I've actually, I've seen similar designs, believe it or not, in ancient Native American cultures, like the Northwest Coast baskets, Navajo designs. And I'm thinking that it's a possibility that maybe this is what the natives were seeing.
Let's go to you, Whitley. What do you think? Have you ever heard of this before?
No, not exactly, but there are a couple of things. First, you need to be sure that there's nothing organic going on in there. In other words, there's nothing wrong with your eyes.
Nothing medical.
You know, so if it persists and becomes a noticeable thing, then you should look at it as a symptom and go to the doctor.
Could be a tumor, for crying out loud.
It could be anything. So, you know, you should definitely check that out on the one hand. On the other hand, in my case, I have this slit, like, in my eye that I can't notice it unless I look against a white background in a fairly brightly lit room, and then I can see it, and there is typing moving across.
Is it like a floater?
No. It's like a little slit, neat little slit window, and I can see typing in it moving across. And in fact, I'm literally looking at it right now, and I can't. It moves, it's too faint, and it moves too quickly generally for me to see what it's saying, but it's there when I'm working or like when I'm doing a show like this, and obviously it's got something to do with it. My brain has been really studied, you'd be surprised at how extensively, and there's nothing in my brain that would explain this. It's, in other words, it's not a brain tumor or a brain anomaly
right.
of any kind. It is definitely an unknown thing. And so far, nobody who has studied it has figured out how we've tried to figure out if we could project it or that various ophthalmological instruments could be used to see it. But that's not possible. And I've tried to...
Can you read the type as it types across your eye?
I can tell it's type, for example,
it's got to be small.
We're talking now. Briefly, I did see the word Whitley go past. Now I see the word wood going past, and I just don't know. I mean, I would say that it's something that's intended to reach me subliminally.
Huh?
And it doesn't. I mean, I never have an urge to go out and do anything strange or anything. I just live my normal life and do my work, and you know, my writing is pretty much my own. I don't feel like it's telling me to write anything. But it, as I said earlier, it's very useful.
How do you know it's not Anne doing that?
Well, that's an interesting thing
because
last April
she's typing these things in heaven.
Well, before Anne passed away, it was going then. It's been going for a couple of years.
Okay.
So I would ask it who you are every once in a while. I never got an answer. But once I was walking across the street in bright sunlight, and sometimes when I'm out and the sun's very bright and I'm in the right situation looking maybe up against a white wall in front of me or something, I can see it in my eye, and I could see it really clearly at that moment. And I said, in my mind, I said, "Who is this?" And the typing came back very clear and very slowly. It's me, Anne.
Ah.
And the reason I did that was that it had changed after Annie passed away. It became a much better tool in terms of research on writing. I wrote this complicated historical novel using this, and I would just think about what I needed, and it would pop into my mind as an idea, and, you know, so-and-so, I wonder what kind of toothpaste he used, and then this name of this would come, and I'd search and search on the internet, and damn if I wouldn't find it every time.
Is it annoying?
No, not at all.
All right.
Not at all. My main concern is that, you know, I'm not alone in here, obviously, and you don't want to think too much about that because it can get feeling, you get to feel a little claustrophobic, but I'm used to it, and it works. You know, I meditate twice a night. I meditate at 11 and at 3, and when I meditate at 3, I can really communicate with it. And it it'll answer essentially any question I ask about anything. And if it can, and if it can't, then I'll find that out because there'll be a silence, a sort of emptiness. And it doesn't answer the questions in the type, but the answers come into my mind as if the type, I'm not seeing it, but it is entering my mind as an idea.
All right.
And I've learned to really dialogue with that very carefully. And, you know, as I've gone from not having any idea what this thing did to being able to use it and dialogue with it and make it useful in my work and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, every once in a while it appears to me that it transmits, because I was rehearsing a speech I was going to give a year ago when I was briefly in the Ozark Mountains UFO conference for one season, and then there was some confusion and I never got invited back again. It's all my fault, as always. That's always the case. But in any case, I was rehearsing the speech in the presence of someone who's had close encounters before, and she said suddenly to me, "Whitley, the top of your left ear has gotten bright red." And I realized it was red and hot, and yeah, it was transmitting. And it was, in other words, someone was picking up the speech to see what I was going to say, because I hadn't been out speaking for years.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the calls. Blair in Sedona, Arizona. Hey, Blair, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, George. Hey, Whitley, when you mentioned the CIA operative going public this evening, I pulled out your 1995 book, Breakthrough, that noted freedom of information releases a CIA document that assumed a magnetic propulsion system for the UFOs, and also, and this relates to my question, how many, many fears had fallen away from you, and for the visitors, there remains only love. Now, today, 22 years later, do you consider the visitors more a potential threat, a potential more like humanity's guides, or more like just observers?
I consider them very reflective. In other words, when I started out with this, I was terrified, and they were frankly difficult and really hard, and a lot of things happened to us. Every single bad thing that is mentioned in the literature anywhere happened to me and Anne. We got hit with all of it. And at the same time, we had an amazing, mind-opening experience, and we decided during about the time we were doing Breakthrough that, you know, we're going to make something out of this, that we're going to try to make it work. And at that time, there was a kind of a very touchy-feely kind of feel to it when I wrote that book. And now it's different in that I'm definitely in a school, and it gets harder as time goes on. They are much less forgiving and much more demanding, and it's really intense in terms of ideas and you know, like when you read Supernatural, you see these all kinds of ideas are flying around in there that have never been anything I've written before, and it's because of this. Because this interaction with them is really intense, and then comes the relationship with Anne, and what happened with Anne is not like the usual sort of guide thing at all. I mean, she's a very sophisticated mind on the other side, and saying all kinds of fascinating and brilliant things. Like, I asked her, what is the difference? Why are we like this? Why don't we perceive her and her type of people more easily? Why does it take mediums or electronic voice phenomena or so forth for us to do it? And she said a fascinating thing. She said, you see the world through a slit. In other words, we don't see all that much of the world. And back in those days, when it was, I had finally gotten past a lot of the fear and was beginning to interact with them in a different way, it was felt very loving. Then in 1989, and right after that book was written, the implant came in, and I started to feel pretty challenged by that. Annie did not want me to get it taken out. It was driving me crazy. I felt I wasn't alone in my own mind. I wanted to get it taken out. We tried. The doctor failed because the thing came to life and moved around in my ear and avoided his scalpel. And I left it. And that's when the more challenging part began. But I wouldn't say it was negative now, no. It's just hard. Real hard. You have no idea.
All right, let's go to Diana on the island of Oahu in Hawaii, west of the Rockies, of course. Hi, Diane, go ahead.
Hi, great show. I wanted to ask Whitley if, like, his son ever, does his son have an implant? Or any family member that have an implant?
Never asked you that, Whitley. Do you have siblings?
I couldn't hear the
If you have siblings, do they have implants as well?
No, I don't know of anyone in my family who has any implants. There's one other person in my family who's had close encounters that I know of that's spoken out. But, you know, my family, like everybody, they're very uneasy and equivocal about this. They don't, you know, some of them think I'm an idiot and others think I'm a genius. And
yeah.
Others think it's all just a bunch of hooey, you know, more Whitley stories. And, you know, it's just the family reflects the world at large, pretty much. But
sure.
No one with implants that I know of.
Does it bother you sometimes that people don't believe you?
Not anymore. I've accepted this is my place in life. I'm out here doing this, and I'm going to do it until the day I die.
And you know what it is.
And then after I die, all of the skeptics and critics and so forth are going to be able to lie about me freely, and they'll take me apart piece by piece.
I have a feeling you'll come back somehow.
If I can, I probably will.
We've got time for maybe one or two more callers. Harry in San Francisco. Go ahead, Harry.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me on.
You too. Do you smell a lot of smoke out that way because of the fires?
Yeah. Oh, it's been crazy. Like when I went into my office today, they've been, you know, upping the system to make sure that. So it's great. It was like, I mean, driving on 280 was crazy. It's just.
I bet.
Looks like smog.
Oh. Okay. Go ahead, Harry.
Oh, sure. Thanks. Whitley, it's so exciting to get to talk to you. So I was curious if you've been watching that People of Earth show, which deals with experiencers, and seems like they specifically set it right near where your cabin was located.
No, I haven't watched it. I watched a little bit of it, but it's like so many of these shows. They you know, they make the show kind of around me in my life without contacting me at all, and it pisses me off a little bit. It annoys me. Excuse me. I'm sorry for my... Forget we're on actual radio.
Live radio with
them. And I, you know, I don't like it very much. They could at least acknowledge my existence.
Henry, still with us?
Oh, yeah, right here.
Yep.
Oh, yeah, great. I'm kind of curious. I mean, I thought it was a little bit of fun, and the only historic people they did mention was Betty and Barney Hill. I was like, oh, good, at least
I'm not historic yet. I'm getting there, though.
And that, of course, has been a great case. The Betty and Barney Hill case. I still don't think, Whitley, there's been one like that.
No, there hasn't. It was a remarkable case, but interestingly enough, there are quite a few cases of interracial couples in this, more than you would think. And it's if someone was interested in finding out more about what that was all about.
Well, we're running out of time. I don't have time to talk with you about Supernatural, but you wrote it with the professor, Jeffrey. And
right,
how'd you find him?
He found me. He's a mythologist, and, you know, I'm one of the great engines of modern myth. And as he's discovered, myth and folklore are based on truth in the sense that people do see things and have experiences, and that's where this material comes from. And, you know, he doesn't know the origin of it. He wouldn't say he knew what a UFO was or whether or not aliens even exist. But the dialogue in that book takes this deeper than it's ever been taken anywhere before. And you come away from that knowing that this is all real, and not only real, it's a rich treasure trove of information and food for thought.
Whitley, I want to thank you for being on the program, and best to you. Anything you need, Whitley, you let us know, okay? Whitley Strieber. We will be back with the ghosts of the Civil War.